Disc 9.
Chapter 26. But Fred did not go to Stone Court the next day, for reasons that were quite peremptory. From those visits to unsanitary Hounslow streets in search of diamond, he had brought back not only a bad bargain in horseflesh, but the further misfortune of some ailment, which for a day or two had seemed mere depression and headache, but which got so much worse when he returned from his visit to Stone Court, that going into the dining room, he threw himself on the sofa, and in answer to his mother's anxious question said, "I feel very ill. I think you must send for Wrench." Wrench came, but did not apprehend anything serious, spoke of a slight derangement, and did not speak of coming again on the morrow. He had a due value for the Vincey's house, but the wariest men are apt to be a little dulled by routine, and on worried mornings will sometimes go through their business with the zest of the daily bell-ringer. Mr. Wrench was a small, neat, bilious man with a well-dressed wig. He had a laborious practice, an irascible temper, a lymphatic wife, and 7 children, and he was already rather late before setting out on a 4 miles drive to meet Dr. Minchin on the other side of Tipton. The decease of Hicks, a rural practitioner, having increased Middlemarch practice in that direction. Great statesmen, and why not small medical men? Mr. Wrench did not neglect sending the usual white parcels, which this time had black and drastic contents. Their effect was not alleviating to poor Fred, who, however, unwilling, as he said, to believe that he was in for an illness, rose at his usual hour the next morning and went downstairs meaning to breakfast, but succeeded in nothing but in sitting and shivering by the fire. Mr. Wrench was again sent for, but was gone on his rounds, and Mrs. Vincey, seeing her darling's changed looks and general misery, began to cry, and said she would send for Dr. Sprague. "Oh, nonsense, mother, it's nothing," said Fred, putting out his hot, dry hand to her. "I shall soon be all right. I must have taken cold in that nasty damp ride." "Mama," said Rosamond, who was seated near the window. The dining-room windows looked on that highly respectable street called Lowick Gate. "There is Mr. Lydgate, stopping to speak to someone. If I were you, I would call him in. He has cured Ellen Bulstrode. They say he cures everyone." Mrs. Vincey sprang to the window and opened it in an instant, thinking only of Fred and not of medical etiquette. Lydgate was only 2 yards off, on the other side of some iron palisading, and turned round at the sudden sound of the sash before she called to him. In 2 minutes he was in the room, and Rosamond went out, after waiting just long enough to show a pretty anxiety, conflicting with her sense of what was becoming. Lydgate had to hear a narrative in which Mrs. Vincey's mind insisted with remarkable instinct on every point of minor importance, especially on what Mr. Wrench had said and had not said about coming again. That there might be an awkward affair with Wrench, Lydgate saw at once, but the case was serious enough to make him dismiss that consideration. He was convinced that Fred was in the pink-skinned stage of typhoid fever, and that he had taken just the wrong medicines. He must go to bed immediately, must have a regular nurse, and various appliances and precautions must be used, about which Lydgate was particular. Poor Mrs. Vincey's terror at these indications of danger found vent in such words as came most easily. She thought it very ill usage on the part of Mr. Wrench, who had attended their house so many years in preference to Mr. Peacock, though Mr. Peacock was equally a friend. Why Mr. Wrench should neglect her children more than others, she could not for the life of her understand. He had not neglected Mrs. Larcher's when they had the measles, nor indeed would Mrs. Vincey have wished that he should, and if anything should happen. Here poor Mrs. Vincey's spirit quite broke down, and her Niobe throat and good-humoured face were sadly convulsed. This was in the hall, out of Fred's hearing. But Rosamond had opened the drawing-room door, and now came forward anxiously. Lydgate apologised for Mr. Wrench, said that the symptoms yesterday might have been disguising, and that this form of fever was very equivocal in its beginnings. He would go immediately to the druggist's and have a prescription made up, in order to lose no time, but he would write to Mr. Wrench and tell him what had been done. "But you must come again. You must go on attending Fred. I can't have my boy left to anybody who may come or not. I bear nobody ill will, thank God, and Mr. Wrench saved me in the pleurisy. But he'd better have let me die if... "I will meet Mr. Wrench here, then, shall I?" said Lydgate, really believing that Wrench was not well prepared to deal wisely with a case of this kind. "Pray make that arrangement, Mr. Lydgate," said Rosamond, coming to her mother's aid and supporting her arm to lead her away. When Mr. Vincey came home, he was very angry with Wrench and did not care if he never came into his house again. Lydgate should go on now, whether Wrench liked it or not. It was no joke to have fever in the house. Everybody must be sent to now, not to come to dinner on Thursday. And Pritchard needn't get up any wine. Brandy was the best thing against infection. "I shall drink brandy," added Mr. Vincey emphatically, as much as to say this was not an occasion for firing with blank cartridges. "He's an uncommonly unfortunate lad, is Fred. He'd need have some luck by and by to make up for all this, else I don't know who'd have an eldest son."
"Don't say so, Vincey," said the mother with a quivering lip, "if you don't want him to be taken from me."
"It will worry you to death, Lucy, that I can see," said Mr. Vincey more mildly. "However, Wrench shall know what I think of the matter." What Mr. Vincey thought confusedly was that the fever might somehow have been hindered if Wrench had shown the proper solicitude about his, the mayor's, family.
"I'm the last man to give in to the cry about new doctors or new parsons either, whether they're Bulstrode's men or not, but Wrench shall know what I think, take it as he will."
Wrench did not take it at all well. Lydgate was as polite as he could be in his offhand way, but politeness in a man who has placed you at a disadvantage is only an additional exasperation, especially if he happens to have been an object of dislike beforehand. Country practitioners used to be an irritable species, susceptible on the point of honour, and Mr. Wrench was one of the most irritable among them. He did not refuse to meet Lydgate in the evening, but his temper was somewhat tried on the occasion. He had to hear Mrs. Vincey say,
"Oh, Mr. Wrench, what have I ever done that you should use me so? To go away and never to come again, and my boy might have been stretched a corpse!"
Mr. Vincey, who had been keeping up a sharp fire on the enemy infection and was a good deal heated in consequence, started up when he heard Wrench come in and went into the hall to let him know what he thought.
"I'll tell you what, Wrench, this is beyond a joke," said the mayor,
who of late had had to rebuke offenders with an official air and now broadened himself by putting his thumbs in his armholes.
"To let fever get unawares into a house like this! There are some things that ought to be actionable and are not so. That's my opinion."
But irrational reproaches were easier to bear than the sense of being instructed, or rather the sense that a younger man, like Lydgate, inwardly considered him in need of instruction. For, in point of fact, Mr. Wrench afterwards said, Lydgate paraded flighty foreign notions which would not wear. He swallowed his ire for the moment, but he afterwards wrote to decline further attendance in the case. The house might be a good one, but Mr. Wrench was not going to truckle to anybody on a professional matter. He reflected, with much probability on his side, that Lydgate would by and by be caught tripping too, and that his ungentlemanly attempts to discredit the sale of drugs by his professional brethren would by and by recoil on himself. He threw out biting remarks on Lydgate's tricks worthy only of a quack to get himself a factitious reputation with credulous people. That cant about cures was never got up by sound practitioners. This was a point on which Lydgate smarted as much as Wrench could desire. To be puffed by ignorance was not only humiliating but perilous, and not more enviable than the reputation of the weather prophet. He was impatient of the foolish expectations amidst which all work must be carried on, and likely enough to damage himself as much as Mr. Wrench could wish by an unprofessional openness. However, Lydgate was installed as medical attendant on the Vincys, and the event was a subject of general conversation in Middlemarch. Some said that the Vincys had behaved scandalously, that Mr. Vincey had threatened Wrench, and that Mrs. Vincey had accused him of poisoning her son. Others were of opinion that Mr. Lydgate's passing by was providential, that he was wonderfully clever in fevers, and that Bulstrode was in the right to bring him forward. Many people believed that Lydgate's coming to the town at all was really due to Bulstrode, and Mrs. Taft, who was always counting stitches and gathered her information in misleading fragments caught between the rows of her knitting, had got it into her head that Mr. Lydgate was a natural son of Bulstrode's, a fact which seemed to justify her suspicions of evangelical laymen. She one day communicated this piece of knowledge to Mrs. Fairbrother, who did not fail to tell her son of it, observing, "I should not be surprised at anything in Bulstrode, but I should be sorry to think it of Mr. Lydgate." "Why, mother," said Mr. Fairbrother, after an explosive laugh, "you know very well that Lydgate is of a good family in the north. He never heard of Bulstrode before he came here." "That is satisfactory so far as Mr. Lydgate is concerned, Camden," said the old lady, with an air of precision. "But as to Bulstrode, the report may be true of some other son." Chapter 27. An eminent philosopher among my friends, who can dignify even your ugly furniture by lifting it into the serene light of science, has shown me this pregnant little fact. Your pier glass, or extensive surface of polished steel made to be rubbed by a housemaid, will be minutely and multitudinously scratched in all directions. But place now against it a lighted candle as a centre of illumination, and lo, the scratches will seem to arrange themselves in a fine series of concentric circles round that little sun. It is demonstrable that the scratches are going everywhere impartially, and it is only your candle which produces the flattering illusion of a concentric arrangement, its light falling with an exclusive optical selection. These things are a parable. The scratches are events, and the candle is the egoism of any person now absent. Of Miss Vincey, for example. Rosamond had a providence of her own, who had kindly made her more charming than other girls, and who seemed to have arranged Fred's illness, and Mr. Wrench's mistake, in order to bring her and Lydgate within effective proximity. It would have been to contravene these arrangements if Rosamond had consented to go away to Stone Court or elsewhere, as her parents wished her to do, especially since Mr. Lydgate thought the precaution needless. Therefore, while Miss Morgan and the children were sent away to a farmhouse the morning after Fred's illness had declared itself, Rosamond refused to leave Papa and Mama. Poor Mama, indeed, was an object to touch any creature born of woman, and Mr. Vincey, who doted on his wife, was more alarmed on her account than on Fred's. But for his insistence, she would have taken no rest. Her brightness was all bedimmed. Unconscious of her costume, which had always been so fresh and gay, she was like a sick bird with languid eye and plumage ruffled, her senses dulled to the sights and sounds that used most to interest her. Fred's delirium, in which she seemed to be wandering out of her reach, tore her heart. After her first outburst against Mr. Wrench, she went about very quietly. Her one low cry was to Lydgate. She would follow him out of the room and put her hand on his arm, moaning out, "Save my boy." Once she pleaded, "He has always been good to me, Mr. Lydgate. He never had a hard word for his mother." As if poor Fred's suffering were an accusation against him. All the deepest fibres of the mother's memory were stirred, and the young man, whose voice took a gentler tone when he spoke to her, was one with the babe whom she had loved, with a love new to her, before he was born. "I have good hope, Mrs. Vincey," Lydgate would say. "Come down with me, and let us talk about the food." In that way, he led her to the parlour where Rosamond was, and made a change for her, surprising her into taking some tea or broth which had been prepared for her. There was a constant understanding between him and Rosamond on these matters. He almost always saw her before going to the sick room, and she appealed to him as to what she could do for Mama. Her presence of mind and adroitness in carrying out his hints were admirable, and it is not wonderful that the idea of seeing Rosamond began to mingle itself with his interest in the case, especially when the critical stage was past and he began to feel confident of Fred's recovery. In the more doubtful time, he had advised calling in Dr. Sprague, who, if he could, would rather have remained neutral on Wrench's account. But after two consultations, the conduct of the case was left to Lydgate, and there was every reason to make him assiduous. Morning and evening he was at Mr. Vincey's, and gradually the visits became cheerful, as Fred became simply feeble, and lay not only in need of the utmost petting, but conscious of it, so that Mrs. Vincey felt as if, after all, the illness had made a festival for her tenderness. Both father and mother held it an added reason for good spirits when old Mr. Featherstone sent messages by Lydgate saying that Fred must make haste and get well, as he, Peter Featherstone, could not do without him and missed his visits sadly. The old man himself was getting bedridden. Mrs. Vincey told these messages to Fred when he could listen, and he turned towards her his delicate, pinched face, from which all the thick blonde hair had been cut away, and in which the eyes seemed to have got larger, yearning for some word about Mary, wondering what she felt about his illness. No word passed his lips, but "to hear with eyes belongs to love's rare wit," and the mother, in the fullness of her heart, not only divined Fred's longing, but felt ready for any sacrifice in order to satisfy him. "If I can only see my boy strong again," she said in her loving folly. "And who knows, perhaps Master of Stone Court? And he can marry anybody he likes then." "Not if they won't have me, Mother," said Fred. The illness had made him childish, and tears came as he spoke. "Oh, take a bit of jelly, my dear," said Mrs. Vincey, secretly incredulous of any such refusal. She never left Fred's side when her husband was not in the house, and thus Rosamond was in the unusual position of being much alone. Lydgate, naturally, never thought of staying long with her, yet it seemed that the brief impersonal conversations they had together were creating that peculiar intimacy which consists in shyness. They were obliged to look at each other in speaking, and somehow the looking could not be carried through as the matter of course which it really was. Lydgate began to feel this sort of consciousness unpleasant, and one day looked down, or anywhere, like an ill-worked puppet. But this turned out badly. The next day Rosamond looked down, and the consequence was that when their eyes met again, both were more conscious than before. There was no help for this in science, and as Lydgate did not want to flirt, there seemed to be no help for it in folly. It was therefore a relief when neighbours no longer considered the house in quarantine, and when the chances of seeing Rosamond alone were very much reduced. But that intimacy of mutual embarrassment, in which each feels that the other is feeling something, having once existed, its effect is not to be done away with. Talk about the weather and other well-bred topics is apt to seem a hollow device, and behaviour can hardly become easy unless it frankly recognises a mutual fascination, which, of course, need not mean anything deep or serious. This was the way in which Rosamond and Lydgate slid gracefully into ease and made their intercourse lively again. Visitors came and went as usual. There was once more music in the drawing-room, and all the extra hospitality of Mr. Vincey's mayoralty returned. Lydgate, whenever he could, took his seat by Rosamond's side and lingered to hear her music, calling himself her captive, meaning all the while not to be her captive. The preposterousness of the notion that he could at once set up a satisfactory establishment as a married man was a sufficient guarantee against danger. This play at being a little in love was agreeable and did not interfere with graver pursuits. Flirtation, after all, was not necessarily a singeing process. Rosamond, for her part, had never enjoyed the days so much in her life before. She was sure of being admired by someone worth captivating, and she did not distinguish flirtation from love, either in herself or in another. She seemed to be sailing with a fair wind just whither she would go, and her thoughts were much occupied with a handsome house in Lowick Gate, which she hoped would by and by be vacant. She was quite determined, when she was married, to rid herself adroitly of all the visitors who were not agreeable to her at her father's, and she imagined the drawing-room in her favourite house with various styles of furniture. Certainly her thoughts were much occupied with Lydgate himself. He seemed to her almost perfect. If he had known his notes, so that his enchantment under her music had been less like an emotional elephant's, and if he had been able to discriminate better the refinements of her taste in dress, she could hardly have mentioned a deficiency in him. How different he was from young Plimdale or Mr. Keyes Larcher! Those young men had not a notion of French, and could speak on no subject with striking knowledge, except perhaps the dyeing and carrying trades, which, of course, they were ashamed to mention. They were Middlemarch gentry, elated with their silver-headed whips and satin stocks, but embarrassed in their manners and timidly jocose. Even Fred was above them, having at least the accent and manner of a university man. Whereas Lydgate was always listened to, bore himself with the careless politeness of conscious superiority, and seemed to have the right clothes on by a certain natural affinity without ever having to think about them. Rosamond was proud when he entered the room, and when he approached her with a distinguishing smile, she had a delicious sense that she was the object of enviable homage. If Lydgate had been aware of all the pride he excited in that delicate bosom, he might have been just as well pleased as any other man, even the most densely ignorant of humoral pathology or fibrous tissue. He held it one of the prettiest attitudes of the feminine mind to adore a man's preeminence, without too precise a knowledge of what it consisted in. But Rosamond was not one of those helpless girls who betray themselves unawares and whose behaviour is awkwardly driven by their impulses instead of being steered by wary grace and propriety. Do you imagine that her rapid forecast and rumination concerning house furniture and society were ever discernible in her conversation, even with her mamma? On the contrary, she would have expressed the prettiest surprise and disapprobation if she had heard that another young lady had been detected in that immodest prematureness, indeed, would probably have disbelieved in its possibility. For Rosamond never showed any unbecoming knowledge, and was always that combination of correct sentiments, music, dancing, drawing, elegant note-writing, private album for extracted verse, and perfect blonde loveliness, which made the irresistible woman for the doomed man of that date. Think no unfair evil of her prey. She had no wicked plots, nothing sordid or mercenary. In fact, she never thought of money except as something necessary which other people would always provide. She was not in the habit of devising falsehoods, and if her statements were no direct clue to fact, why, they were not intended in that light. They were among her elegant accomplishments, intended to please. Nature had inspired many arts in finishing Mrs. Lemon's favourite pupil, who by general consent, Fred's excepted, was a rare compound of beauty, cleverness, and amiability. Lydgate found it more and more agreeable to be with her, and there was no constraint now. There was a delightful interchange of influence in their eyes, and what they said had that superfluity of meaning for them which is observable with some sense of flatness by a third person. Still, they had no interviews or asides from which a third person need have been excluded. In fact, they flirted, and Lydgate was secure in the belief that they did nothing else. If a man could not love and be wise, surely he could flirt and be wise at the same time. Really, the men in Middlemarch, except Mr. Fairbrother, were great bores, and Lydgate did not care about commercial politics or cards. What was he to do for relaxation? He was often invited to the Bulstrodes, but the girls there were hardly out of the schoolroom, and Mrs. Bulstrode's naive way of conciliating piety and worldliness, the nothingness of this life and the desirability of cut glass, the consciousness at once of filthy rags and the best damask, was not a sufficient relief from the weight of her husband's invariable seriousness. The Vincey's house, with all its faults, was the pleasanter by contrast. Besides, it nourished Rosamond, sweet to look at as a half-opened blush rose, and adorned with accomplishments for the refined amusement of man. But he made some enemies other than medical by his success with Miss Vincey. One evening he came into the drawing-room rather late, when several other visitors were there. The card-table had drawn off the elders, and Mr. Ned Plimdale, one of the good matches in Middlemarch, though not one of its leading minds, was in tête-à-tête with Rosamond. He had brought the last keepsake, the gorgeous watered silk publication which marked modern progress at that time, and he considered himself very fortunate that he could be the first to look over it with her, dwelling on the ladies and gentlemen with shiny copperplate cheeks and copperplate smiles, and pointing to comic verses as capital and sentimental stories as interesting. Rosamond was gracious, and Mr. Ned was satisfied that he had the very best thing in art and literature as a medium for paying addresses, the very thing to please a nice girl. He had also reasons, deep rather than ostensible, for being satisfied with his own appearance. To superficial observers, his chin had too vanishing an aspect, looking as if it were being gradually reabsorbed, and it did indeed cause him some difficulty about the fit of his satin stocks, for which chins were at that time useful. "I think the Honourable Mrs. S. is something like you," said Mr. Ned. He kept the book open at the bewitching portrait, and looked at it rather languishingly.
"Her back is very large. She seems to have sat for that," said Rosamond, not meaning any satire, but thinking how red young Plimdale's hands were, and wondering why Lydgate did not come. She went on with her tatting all the while.
"I did not say she was as beautiful as you are," said Mr. Ned, venturing to look from the portrait to its rival.
"I suspect you of being an adroit flatterer," said Rosamond, feeling sure that she should have to reject this young gentleman a second time.
But now Lydgate came in. The book was closed before he reached Rosamond's corner, and as he took his seat with easy confidence on the other side of her, young Plimdale's jaw fell like a barometer towards the cheerless side of change. Rosamond enjoyed not only Lydgate's presence, but its effect. She liked to excite jealousy.
"What a latecomer you are," she said as they shook hands. "Mama had given you up a little while ago. How do you find Fred?"
"As usual, going on well, but slowly. I want him to go away. To Stone Court, for example. But your mamma seems to have some objection."
"Poor fellow," said Rosamond, prettily. "You will see Fred so changed," she added, turning to the other suitor. "We have looked to Mr. Lydgate as our guardian angel during his illness."
Mr. Ned smiled nervously, while Lydgate, drawing the keepsake towards him and opening it, gave a short, scornful laugh, and tossed up his chin as if in wonderment at human folly.
"What are you laughing at so profanely?" said Rosamond, with bland neutrality.
"I wonder which would turn out to be the silliest, the engravings or the writing here," said Lydgate, in his most convinced tone, while he turned over the pages quickly, seeming to see all through the book in no time, and showing his large white hands to much advantage, as Rosamond thought. "Do look at this bridegroom coming out of church! Did you ever see such a sugared invention, as the Elizabethans used to say? Did any haberdasher ever look so smirking? Yet I will answer for it, the story makes him one of the first gentlemen in the land."
"You are so severe, I am frightened at you," said Rosamond, keeping her amusement duly moderate.
Poor young Plimdale had lingered with admiration over this very engraving, and his spirit was stirred. "There are a great many celebrated people writing in the keepsake at all events," he said, in a tone at once piqued and timid. "This is the first time I have heard it called silly."
"I think I shall turn round on you and accuse you of being a Goth," said Rosamond, looking at Lydgate with a smile.
I suspect you know nothing about Lady Blessington and L.E.L.
Rosamond herself was not without relish for these writers, but she did not readily commit herself by admiration, and was alive to the slightest hint that anything was not, according to Lydgate, in the very highest taste.
"But Sir Walter Scott, I suppose Mr. Lydgate knows him," said young Plimdale, a little cheered by this advantage.
"Oh, I read no literature now," said Lydgate, shutting the book and pushing it away. "I read so much when I was a lad that I suppose it will last me all my life. I used to know Scott's poems by heart."
"I should like to know when you left off," said Rosamond, "because then I might be sure that I knew something which you did not know."
"Mr. Lydgate would say that was not worth knowing," said Mr. Ned, purposely caustic. "On the contrary," said Lydgate, showing no smart, but smiling with exasperating confidence at Rosamond. "It would be worth knowing by the fact that Miss Vincey could tell it me." Young Plimdale soon went to look at the whist playing, thinking that Lydgate was one of the most conceited, unpleasant fellows it had ever been his ill fortune to meet.
"How rash you are," said Rosamond, inwardly delighted. "Do you see that you have given offence?"
"What?
Is it Mr. Plimdale's book? I am sorry, I didn't think about it." "I shall begin to admit what you said of yourself when you first came here, that you are a bear and want teaching by the birds."
"Well, there is a bird who can teach me what she will. Don't I listen to her willingly?"
To Rosamond, it seemed as if she and Lydgate were as good as engaged. That they were some time to be engaged had long been an idea in her mind, and ideas, we know, tend to a more solid kind of existence, the necessary materials being at hand. It is true Lydgate had the counter-idea of remaining unengaged, but this was a mere negative, a shadow cast by other resolves which themselves were capable of shrinking. Circumstance was almost sure to be on the side of Rosamond's idea, which had a shaping activity and looked through watchful blue eyes, whereas Lydgate's lay blind and unconcerned as a jellyfish which gets melted without knowing it. That evening, when he went home, he looked at his files to see how a process of maceration was going on with undisturbed interest, and he wrote out his daily notes with as much precision as usual. The reveries from which it was difficult for him to detach himself were ideal constructions of something else than Rosamond's virtues, and the primitive tissue was still his fair unknown. Moreover, he was beginning to feel some zest for the growing, though half-suppressed feud between him and the other medical men which was likely to become more manifest now that Bulstrode's method of managing the new hospital was about to be declared. And there were various inspiriting signs that his non-acceptance by some of Peacock's patients might be counterbalanced by the impression he had produced in other quarters. Only a few days later, when he had happened to overtake Rosamond on the Lowick Road and had got down from his horse to walk by her side until he had quite protected her from a passing drove, he had been stopped by a servant on horseback with a message calling him in to a house of some importance where Peacock had never attended, and it was the second instance of this kind. The servant was Sir James Chettam's, and the house was Lowick Manor.
Chapter 28. Mr. and Mrs. Casaubon, returning from their wedding journey, arrived at Lowick Manor in the middle of January. A light snow was falling as they descended at the door, and in the morning, when Dorothea passed from her dressing-room into the blue-green boudoir that we know of, she saw the long avenue of limes lifting their trunks from a white earth and spreading white branches against the dun and motionless sky. The distant flat shrank in uniform whiteness and low-hanging uniformity of cloud. The very furniture in the room seemed to have shrunk since she saw it before. The stag in the tapestry looked more like a ghost in his ghostly blue-green world, The volumes of polite literature in the bookcase looked more like immovable imitations of books. The bright fire of dry oak boughs burning on the dogs seemed an incongruous renewal of life and glow, like the figure of Dorothea herself as she entered carrying the red leather cases containing the cameos for Celia. She was glowing from her morning toilette as only healthful youth can glow. There was gem-like brightness on her coiled hair and in her hazel eyes. There was warm red life in her lips. Her throat had a breathing whiteness above the differing white of the fur, which itself seemed to wind about her neck and cling down her blue-grey pelisse, with a tenderness gathered from her own, a sentient, commingled innocence which kept its loveliness against the crystalline purity of the outdoor snow. As she laid the cameo cases on the table in the bow window, she unconsciously kept her hands on them, immediately absorbed in looking out on the still, white enclosure which made her visible world. Mr. Casaubon, who had risen early complaining of palpitation, was in the library, giving audience to his curate, Mr. Tucker. By and by, Celia would come, in her quality of bridesmaid as well as sister, and through the next weeks there would be wedding visits received and given, all in continuance of that transitional life understood to correspond with the excitement of bridal felicity, and keeping up the sense of busy ineffectiveness, as of a dream which the dreamer begins to suspect. The duties of her married life, contemplated as so great beforehand, seemed to be shrinking with the furniture and the white vapour-walled landscape. The clear heights, where she expected to walk in full communion, had become difficult to see even in her imagination. The delicious repose of the soul on a complete superior had been shaken into uneasy effort and alarmed with dim presentiment. When would the days begin of that active wifely devotion which was to strengthen her husband's life and exalt her own? Never, perhaps, as she had preconceived them, but somehow, still somehow. In this solemnly pledged union of her life, duty would present itself in some new form of inspiration, and give a new meaning to wifely love. Meanwhile, there was the snow and the low arch of dun vapour. There was the stifling oppression of that gentlewoman's world where everything was done for her and none asked for her aid, where the sense of connection with a manifold pregnant existence had to be kept up painfully as an inward vision instead of coming from without in claims that would have shaped her energies. "What shall I do?" "Whatever you please, my dear." That had been her brief history since she had left off learning morning lessons and practicing silly rhythms on the hated piano. Marriage, which was to bring guidance into worthy and imperative occupation, had not yet freed her from the gentlewoman's oppressive liberty. It had not even filled her leisure with the ruminant joy of unchecked tenderness. Her blooming, full-pulsed youth stood there in a moral imprisonment, which made itself one with the chill, colourless, narrowed landscape, with the shrunken furniture, the never-read books, and the ghostly stag, in a pale, fantastic world that seemed to be vanishing from the daylight. In the first minutes when Dorothea looked out, she felt nothing but the dreary oppression. Then came a keen remembrance, and turning away from the window, she walked round the room. The ideas and hopes which were living in her mind when she first saw this room nearly 3 months before were present now only as memories. She judged them as we judge transient and departed things. All existence seemed to beat with a lower pulse than her own, and her religious faith was a solitary cry, the struggle out of a nightmare, in which every object was withering and shrinking away from her. Each remembered thing in the room was disenchanted, was deadened as an unlit transparency. Till her wandering gaze came to the group of miniatures, and there, at last, she saw something which had gathered new breath and meaning. It was the miniature of Mr. Casaubon's aunt, Julia, who had made the unfortunate marriage, of Will Ladislaw's grandmother. Dorothea could fancy that it was alive now, the delicate woman's face which yet had a headstrong look, a peculiarity difficult to interpret. Was it only her friends who thought her marriage unfortunate? or did she herself find it out to be a mistake, and taste the salt bitterness of her tears in the merciful silence of the night? What breadths of experience Dorothea seemed to have passed over since she first looked at this miniature. She felt a new companionship with it, as if it had an ear for her, and could see how she was looking at it. Here was a woman who had known some difficulty about marriage. Nay, the colours deepened, the lips and chin seemed to get larger, the hair and eyes seemed to be sending out light. The face was masculine, and beamed on her with that full gaze which tells her on whom it falls that she is too interesting for the slightest movement of her eyelid to pass unnoticed and uninterpreted. The vivid presentation came like a pleasant glow to Dorothea. She felt herself smiling, and turning from the miniature, sat down and looked up, as if she were again talking to a figure in front of her. But the smile disappeared as she went on meditating. And at last she said aloud, "Oh, it was cruel to speak so. How sad! How dreadful!" She rose quickly and went out of the room, hurrying along the corridor with the irresistible impulse to go and see her husband and inquire if she could do anything for him. Perhaps Mr. Tucker was gone, and Mr. Casaubon was alone in the library. She felt as if all her morning's gloom would vanish if she could see her husband glad because of her presence. But when she reached the head of the dark oak staircase, there was Celia coming up, and below there was Mr. Brooke, exchanging welcomes and congratulations with Mr. Casaubon. "Dodo," said Celia in her quiet staccato, then kissed her sister, whose arms encircled her, and said no more. I think they both cried a little, in a furtive manner, while Dorothea ran downstairs to greet her uncle.
"I need not ask how you are, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, after kissing her forehead. "Rome has agreed with you, I see. Happiness, frescoes, the antique, that sort of thing. Well, it's very pleasant to have you back again. And you understand all about art now, eh? But Casaubon is a little pale, I tell him, a little pale, you know. Studying hard in his holidays is carrying it rather too far. I overdid it at one time."
Mr. Brooke still held Dorothea's hand, but had turned his face to Mr. Casaubon.
"About topography, ruins, temples. I thought I had a clue, but I saw it would carry me too far, and nothing might have come of it. You may go any length in that sort of thing, and nothing may come of it, you know."
Dorothea's eyes also were turned up to her husband's face, with some anxiety at the idea that those who saw him afresh after absence might be aware of signs which she had not noticed.
"Nothing to alarm you, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, observing her expression. "A little English beef and mutton will soon make a difference. It was all very well to look pale sitting for the portrait of Aquinas, you know. We got your letter just in time. But Aquinas, now, he was a little too subtle, wasn't he? Does anybody read Aquinas?"
"He is not, indeed, an author adapted to superficial minds," said Mr. Casaubon, meeting these timely questions with dignified patience.
"You would like coffee in your own room, Uncle?" said Dorothea, coming to the rescue.
"Yes, and you must go to Celia. She has great news to tell you, you know. I leave it all to her."
The blue-green boudoir looked much more cheerful when Celia was seated there, in a pelisse exactly like her sister's, surveying the cameos with a placid satisfaction, while the conversation passed on to other topics.
"Do you think it nice to go to Rome on a wedding journey?" said Celia, with her ready, delicate blush, which Dorothea was used to on the smallest occasion.
"It would not suit all. Not you, dear, for example," said Dorothea quietly.
No one would ever know what she thought of a wedding journey to Rome.
"Mrs. Cadwallader says it is nonsense, people going a long journey when they are married. She says they get tired to death of each other and can't quarrel comfortably as they would at home. And Lady Chetham says she went to Bath."
Celia's colour changed again and again, seemed to come and go with tidings from the heart, as it a running messenger had been. It must mean more than Celia's blushing usually did.
"Celia, has something happened?" said Dorothea,
in a tone full of sisterly feeling. "Have you really any great news to tell me?"
"It was because you went away, Dodo. Then there was nobody but me for Sir James to talk to,"
said Celia, with a certain roguishness in her eyes. "I understand. It is as I used to hope and believe," said Dorothea, taking her sister's face between her hands and looking at her half anxiously. Celia's marriage seemed more serious than it used to do.
"It was only 3 days ago," said Celia, "and Lady Chetham is very kind."
"And you are very happy?"
"Yes. We are not going to be married yet, because everything is to be got ready. And I don't want to be married so very soon, because I think it is nice to be engaged. And we shall be married all our lives after."
"I do believe you could not marry better, Kitty. Sir James is a good, honourable man," said Dorothea warmly.
"He has gone on with the cottages, Dodo. He will tell you about them when he comes. Shall you be glad to see him?"
"Of course I shall. How can you ask me?"
"Only I was afraid you would be getting so learned," said Celia, regarding Mr. Casaubon's learning as a kind of damp which might in due time saturate a neighbouring body.
Chapter 29. One morning, some weeks after her arrival at Lowick, Dorothea... But why always Dorothea? Was her point of view the only possible one with regard to this marriage? I protest against all our interest, all our effort at understanding being given to the young skins that look blooming in spite of trouble. For these too will get faded, and will know the older and more eating griefs which we are helping to neglect. In spite of the blinking eyes and white moles objectionable to Celia, and the want of muscular curve which was morally painful to Sir James, Mr. Casaubon had an intense consciousness within him, and was spiritually a-hungered like the rest of us. He had done nothing exceptional in marrying, nothing but what society sanctions and considers an occasion for wreaths and bouquets. It had occurred to him that he must not any longer defer his intention of matrimony, and he had reflected that in taking a wife, a man of good position should expect and carefully choose a blooming young lady. The younger the better, because more educable and submissive, of a rank equal to his own, of religious principles, virtuous disposition, and good understanding. On such a young lady he would make handsome settlements, and he would neglect no arrangement for her happiness. In return, he should receive family pleasures, and leave behind him that copy of himself which seemed so urgently required of a man, to the sonneteers of the 16th century. Times had altered since then, and no sonneteer had insisted on Mr. Casaubon's leaving a copy of himself. Moreover, he had not yet succeeded in issuing copies of his mythological key, but he had always intended to acquit himself by marriage, and the sense that he was fast leaving the years behind him, that the world was getting dimmer, and that he felt lonely, was a reason to him for losing no more time in overtaking domestic delights before they too were left behind by the years. And when he had seen Dorothea, he believed that he had found even more than he demanded. She might really be such a helpmate to him as would enable him to dispense with a hired secretary, an aid which Mr. Casaubon had never yet employed and had a suspicious dread of. Mr. Casaubon was nervously conscious that he was expected to manifest a powerful mind. Providence, in its kindness, had supplied him with the wife he needed. A wife, a modest young lady with the purely appreciative, unambitious abilities of her sex, is sure to think her husband's mind powerful. Whether Providence had taken equal care of Miss Brooke in presenting her with Mr. Casaubon was an idea which could hardly occur to him. Society never made the preposterous demand that a man should think as much about his own qualifications for making a charming girl happy as he thinks of hers for making himself happy. As if a man could choose not only his wife, but his wife's husband. or as if he were bound to provide charms for his posterity in his own person. When Dorothea accepted him with effusion, that was only natural, and Mr. Casaubon believed that his happiness was going to begin. He had not had much foretaste of happiness in his previous life. To know intense joy without a strong bodily frame, one must have an enthusiastic soul. Mr. Casaubon had never had a strong bodily frame, and his soul was sensitive without being enthusiastic. It was too languid to thrill out of self-consciousness into passionate delight. It went on fluttering in the swampy ground where it was hatched, thinking of its wings, and never flying. His experience was of that pitiable kind, which shrinks from pity, and fears most of all that it should be known. It was that proud, narrow sensitiveness which has not mass enough to spare for transformation into sympathy, and quivers thread-like in small currents of self-preoccupation, or at best of an egoistic scrupulosity. And Mr. Casaubon had many scruples. He was capable of a severe self-restraint. He was resolute in being a man of honour according to the code. He would be unimpeachable by any recognised opinion. In conduct, these ends had been attained. But the difficulty of making his key to all mythologies unimpeachable weighed like lead upon his mind. And the pamphlets, or parerga, as he called them, by which he tested his public and deposited small, monumental records of his march, were far from having been seen in all their significance. He suspected the archdeacon of not having read them. He was in painful doubt as to what was really thought of them by the leading minds of Brasenose, and bitterly convinced that his old acquaintance, Carp, had been the writer of that depreciatory recension which was kept locked in a small drawer of Mr. Casaubon's desk, and also in a dark closet of his verbal memory. These were heavy impressions to struggle against, and brought that melancholy embitterment which is the consequence of all excessive claim. Even his religious faith wavered with his wavering trust in his own authorship, and the consolations of the Christian hope in immortality seemed to lean on the immortality of the still unwritten key to all mythologies. For my part, I am very sorry for him. It is an uneasy lot at best, to be what we call highly taught, and yet not to enjoy. To be present at this great spectacle of life, and never to be liberated from a small, hungry, shivering self. Never to be fully possessed by the glory we behold. Never to have our consciousness rapturously transformed into the vividness of a thought, the ardour of a passion, the energy of an action, but always to be scholarly and uninspired, ambitious and timid, scrupulous and dim-sighted. Becoming a dean or even a bishop would make little difference, I fear, to Mr. Casaubon's uneasiness. Doubtless some ancient Greek has observed that behind the big mask and the speaking trumpet, there must always be our poor little eyes peeping as usual, and our timorous lips more or less under anxious control. To this mental estate, mapped out a quarter of a century before, to sensibilities thus fenced in, Mr. Casaubon had thought of annexing happiness with a lovely young bride. But even before marriage, as we have seen, he found himself under a new depression, in the consciousness that the new bliss was not blissful to him. Inclination yearned back to its old, easier custom, and the deeper he went in domesticity, the more did the sense of acquitting himself and acting with propriety predominate over any other satisfaction. Marriage, like religion and erudition, nay, like authorship itself, was fated to become an outward requirement, and Edward Casaubon was bent on fulfilling unimpeachably all requirements. Even drawing Dorothea into use in his study, according to his own intention before marriage, was an effort which he was always tempted to defer, and but for her pleading insistence it might never have begun. But she had succeeded in making it a matter of course that she should take her place at an early hour in the library and have work either of reading aloud or copying assigned her. The work had been easier to define because Mr. Casaubon had adopted an immediate intention. There was to be a new Paragon, a small monograph on some lately traced indications concerning the Egyptian mysteries, whereby certain assertions of Warburton's could be corrected. References were extensive even here, but not altogether shoreless, and sentences were actually to be written in the shape wherein they would be scanned by Brasenose and a less formidable posterity. These minor monumental productions were always exciting to Mr. Casaubon. Digestion was made difficult by the interference of citations or by the rivalry of dialectical phrases ringing against each other in his brain. And from the first, there was to be a Latin dedication, about which everything was uncertain except that it was not to be addressed to Carp. It was a poisonous regret to Mr. Casaubon that he had once addressed a dedication to Carp, in which he had numbered that member of the animal kingdom among the viros nullo evo perituros, a mistake which would infallibly lay the dedicator open to ridicule in the next age, and might even be chuckled over by Pike and Tench in the present. Thus Mr. Casaubon was in one of his busiest epochs. And as I began to say a little while ago, Dorothea joined him early in the library, where he had breakfasted alone. Celia at this time was on a second visit to Lowick, probably the last before her marriage, and was in the drawing-room expecting Sir James. Dorothea had learned to read the signs of her husband's mood, and she saw that the morning had become more foggy there during the last hour. She was going silently to her desk, when he said, in that distant tone which implied that he was discharging a disagreeable duty,
"Dorothea, here is a letter for you, which was enclosed in one addressed to me."
It was a letter of 2 pages, and she immediately looked at the signature.
"Mr. Ladislaw, what can he have to say to me?" she exclaimed in a tone of pleased surprise.
"But," she added, looking at Mr. Casaubon, "I can imagine what he has written to you about."
"You can, if you please, read the letter," said Mr. Casaubon, severely pointing to it with his pen and not looking at her. "But I may as well say beforehand that I must decline the proposal it contains to pay a visit here. I trust I may be excused for desiring an interval of complete freedom from such distractions as have been hitherto inevitable, and especially from guests whose desultory vivacity makes their presence a fatigue."
There had been no clashing of temper between Dorothea and her husband since that little explosion in Rome, which had left such strong traces in her mind that it had been easier ever since to quell emotion than to incur the consequence of venting it. But this ill-tempered anticipation that she could desire visits which might be disagreeable to her husband, this gratuitous defence of himself against selfish complaint on her part, was too sharp a sting to be meditated on until after it had been resented. Dorothea had thought that she could have been patient with John Milton, but she had never imagined him behaving in this way. And for a moment, Mr. Casaubon seemed to be stupidly undiscerning and odiously unjust. Pity, that newborn babe which was by and by to rule many a storm within her, did not stride the blast on this occasion. With her first words, uttered in a tone that shook him, she startled Mr. Casaubon into looking at her and meeting the flash of her eyes. "Why do you attribute to me a wish for anything that would annoy you? You speak to me as if I were something you had to contend against. Wait at least till I appear to consult my own pleasure apart from yours."
"Dorothea, you are hasty," answered Mr. Casaubon nervously.
Decidedly, this woman was too young to be on the formidable level of wifehood, unless she had been pale and featureless and taken everything for granted.
"I think it was you who were first hasty in your false suppositions about my feeling," said Dorothea in the same tone.
The fire was not dissipated yet, and she thought it was ignoble in her husband not to apologize to her.
We will, if you please, say no more on this subject, Dorothea. I have neither leisure nor energy for this kind of debate.
Here, Mr. Casaubon dipped his pen and made as if he would return to his writing, though his hand trembled so much that the words seemed to be written in an unknown character. There are answers which, in turning away wrath, only send it to the other end of the room, and to have a discussion coolly waived when you feel that justice is all on your own side is even more exasperating in marriage than in philosophy. Dorothea left Ladislaw's two letters unread on her husband's writing-table and went to her own place, the scorn and indignation within her rejecting the reading of these letters, just as we hurl away any trash towards which we seem to have been suspected of mean cupidity. She did not in the least divine the subtle sources of her husband's bad temper about these letters. She only knew that they had caused him to offend her. She began to work at once, and her hand did not tremble. On the contrary, in writing out the quotations which had been given to her the day before, she felt that she was forming her letters beautifully, and it seemed to her that she saw the construction of the Latin she was copying, and which she was beginning to understand, more clearly than usual. In her indignation there was a sense of superiority, but it went out for the present in firmness of stroke, and did not compress itself into an inward articulate voice, pronouncing the once affable archangel a poor creature. There had been this apparent quiet for half an hour, and Dorothea had not looked away from her own table, when she heard the loud bang of a book on the floor, and turning quickly, saw Mr. Casaubon on the library steps, clinging forward as if he were in some bodily distress. She started up and bounded towards him in an instant. He was evidently in great straits for breath. Jumping on a stool, she got close to his elbow and said, with her whole soul melted into tender alarm, "Can you lean on me, dear?" He was still for 2 or 3 minutes, which seemed endless to her, unable to speak or move, gasping for breath. When at last he descended the 3 steps and fell backwards in the large chair which Dorothea had drawn close to the foot of the ladder, he no longer gasped, but seemed helpless and about to faint. Dorothea rang the bell violently, and presently Mr. Casaubon was helped to the couch. He did not faint, and was gradually reviving, when Sir James Chettam came in, having been met in the hall with the news that Mr. Casaubon had had a fit in the library. "Good God, this is just what might have been expected," was his immediate thought. If his prophetic soul had been urged to particularize, it seemed to him that fits would have been the definite expression alighted upon. He asked his informant, the butler, whether the doctor had been sent for. The butler never knew his master want the doctor before, but would it not be right to send for a physician? When Sir James entered the library, however, Mr. Casaubon could make some signs of his usual politeness, and Dorothea, who in the reaction from her first terror had been kneeling and sobbing by his side, now rose, and herself proposed that someone should ride off for a medical man. "I recommend you to send for Lydgate," said Sir James. "My mother has called him in, and she has found him uncommonly clever. She has had a poor opinion of the physician since my father's death." Dorothea appealed to her husband, and he made a silent sign of approval. So Mr. Lydgate was sent for. And he came wonderfully soon, for the messenger, who was Sir James Chettam's man and knew Mr. Lydgate, met him leading his horse along the Lowick Road and giving his arm to Miss Vincey. Celia, in the drawing-room, had known nothing of the trouble till Sir James told her of it. After Dorothea's account, he no longer considered the illness a fit, but still something of that nature. "Poor dear Dodo, how dreadful," said Celia, feeling as much grieved as her own perfect happiness would allow. Her little hands were clasped and enclosed by Sir James's as a bud is enfolded by a liberal calyx. "It is very shocking that Mr. Casaubon should be ill, but I never did like him. And I think he is not half fond enough of Dorothea, and he ought to be, for I am sure no one else would have had him. Do you think they would?"
"I always thought it a horrible sacrifice of your sister," said Sir James.
"Yes,
But poor Dodo never did do what other people do, and I think she never will.
She is a noble creature, said the loyal-hearted Sir James. He had just had a fresh impression of this kind, as he had seen Dorothea stretching her tender arm under her husband's neck and looking at him with unspeakable sorrow. He did not know how much penitence there was in the sorrow.
Yes, said Celia, thinking it was very well for Sir James to say so, but he would not have been comfortable with Dodo.
Shall I go to her? Could I help her, do you think?
I think it would be well for you just to go and see her before Lydgate comes, said Sir James, magnanimously. Only don't stay long. While Celia was gone, he walked up and down, remembering what he had originally felt about Dorothea's engagement, and feeling a revival of his disgust at Mr. Brooke's indifference. If Cadwallader, if everyone else, had regarded the affair as he, Sir James, had done, the marriage might have been hindered. It was wicked to let a young girl blindly decide her fate in that way, without any effort to save her. Sir James had long ceased to have any regrets on his own account. His heart was satisfied with his engagement to Celia. But he had a chivalrous nature. Was not the disinterested service of woman among the ideal glories of old chivalry? His disregarded love had not turned to bitterness. Its death had made sweet odours, floating memories that clung with a consecrating effect to Dorothea. He could remain her brotherly friend, interpreting her actions with generous trustfulness.
Chapter 30. Mr. Casaubon had no second attack of equal severity with the first, and in a few days began to recover his usual condition. But Lydgate seemed to think the case worth a great deal of attention. He not only used his stethoscope, which had not become a matter of course in practice at that time, but sat quietly by his patient and watched him. To Mr. Casaubon's questions about himself, he replied that the source of the illness was the common error of intellectual men, a too eager and monotonous application. The remedy was to be satisfied with moderate work and to seek variety of relaxation. Mr. Brooke, who sat by on one occasion, suggested that Mr. Casaubon should go fishing, as Cadwallader did, and have a turning room, make toys, table legs, and that kind of thing.
"In short, you recommend me to anticipate the arrival of my second childhood," said poor Mr. Casaubon with some bitterness. "These things," he added, looking at Lydgate, "would be to me such relaxation as toe-picking is to prisoners in a house of correction."
"I confess," said Lydgate, smiling, "amusement is rather an unsatisfactory prescription. It is something like telling people to keep up their spirits. Perhaps I had better say that you must submit to be mildly bored rather than to go on working."
"Yes, yes," said Mr. Brooke. "Get Dorothea to play backgammon with you in the evenings. And shuttlecock now. I don't know a finer game than shuttlecock for the daytime. I remember it all the fashion."
"To be sure, your eyes might not stand that, Casaubon, but you must unbend, you know.
Why, you might take to some light study. Oncology, now. I always think that must be a light study. Or get Dorothea to read you light things. Smollett, Roderick Random, Humphrey Clinker. They are a little broad, but she may read anything now she's married, you know.
I remember they made me laugh uncommonly. There's a droll bit about a postillion's breeches.
We have no such humour now. I have gone through all these things, but they might be rather new to you."
"As new as eating thistles," would have been an answer to represent Mr. Casaubon's feelings, but he only bowed resignedly, with due respect to his wife's uncle, and observed that doubtless the works he mentioned had served as a resource to a certain order of mind.
"You see," said the able magistrate to Lydgate when they were outside the door, "Casaubon has been a little narrow. It leaves him rather at a loss when you forbid him his particular work, which I believe is something very deep indeed, in the line of research, you know. I would never give way to that. I was always versatile. But a clergyman is tied a little tight.
if they would make him a bishop now. He did a very good pamphlet for Peel. He would have more movement then, more show. He might get a little flesh. But I recommend you to talk to Mrs. Casaubon. She is clever enough for anything, is my niece. Tell her her husband wants liveliness, diversion. Put her on amusing tactics.
Without Mr. Brooke's advice, Lydgate had determined on speaking to Dorothea. She had not been present while her uncle was throwing out his pleasant suggestions as to the mode in which life at Lowick might be enlivened, but she was usually by her husband's side, and the unaffected signs of intense anxiety in her face and voice, about whatever touched his mind or health, made a drama which Lydgate was inclined to watch. He said to himself that he was only doing right in telling her the truth about her husband's probable future, but he certainly thought also that it would be interesting to talk confidentially with her. A medical man likes to make psychological observations, and sometimes, in the pursuit of such studies, is too easily tempted into momentous prophecy, which life and death easily set at naught. Lydgate had often been satirical on this gratuitous prediction, and he meant now to be guarded. He asked for Mrs. Casaubon, but being told that she was out walking, he was going away. When Dorothea and Celia appeared, both glowing from their struggle with the March wind. When Lydgate begged to speak with her alone, Dorothea opened the library door, which happened to be the nearest, thinking of nothing at the moment but what he might have to say about Mr. Casaubon. It was the first time she had entered this room since her husband had been taken ill, and the servant had chosen not to open the shutters. But there was light enough to read by, from the narrow upper panes of the windows. "You will not mind this sombre light," said Dorothea, standing in the middle of the room. "Since you forbade books, the library has been out of the question. But Mr. Casaubon will soon be here again, I hope. Is he not making progress?"
"Yes, much more rapid progress than I had first expected. Indeed, he is already nearly in his usual state of health."
"You do not fear that the illness will return?" said Dorothea, whose quick ear had detected some significance in Lydgate's tone.
"Such cases are peculiarly difficult to pronounce upon," said Lydgate. "The only point on which I can be confident is that it will be desirable to be very watchful on Mr. Casaubon's account, lest he should in any way strain his nervous power."
"I beseech you to speak quite plainly," said Dorothea in an imploring tone. "I cannot bear to think that there might be something which I did not know, and which, if I had known it, would have made me act differently." The words came out like a cry. It was evident that they were the voice of some mental experience which lay not very far off. "Sit down," she added, placing herself on the nearest chair, and throwing off her bonnet and gloves with an instinctive discarding of formality where a great question of destiny was concerned.
"What you say now justifies my own view," said Lydgate. "I think it is one's function as a medical man to hinder regrets of that sort as far as possible. But I beg you to observe that Mr. Casaubon's case is precisely of the kind in which the issue is most difficult to pronounce upon. He may possibly live for 15 years or more, without much worse health than he has had hitherto."
Dorothea had turned very pale, and when Lydgate paused, she said in a low voice, "You mean, if we are very careful?"
"Yes. Careful against mental agitation of all kinds, and against excessive application."
"He would be miserable if he had to give up his work," said Dorothea, with a quick prevision of that wretchedness.
"I am aware of that. The only course is to try by all means, direct and indirect, to moderate and vary his occupations. With a happy concurrence of circumstances, there is, as I said, no immediate danger from that affection of the heart which I believe to have been the cause of his late attack. On the other hand, it is possible that the disease may develop itself more rapidly. It is one of those cases in which death is sometimes sudden. Nothing should be neglected which might be affected by such an issue." There was silence for a few moments, while Dorothea sat as if she had been turned to marble, though the life within her was so intense that her mind had never before swept in brief time over an equal range of scenes and motives.
"Help me pray," she said at last, in the same low voice as before. "Tell me what I can do."
"What do you think of foreign travel? You have been lately in Rome, I think." The memories which made this resource utterly hopeless were a new current that shook Dorothea out of her pallid immobility.
"Oh, that would not do. That would be worse than anything," she said, with a more childlike despondency, while the tears rolled down. "Nothing will be of any use that he does not enjoy."
"I wish that I could have spared you this pain," said Lydgate, deeply touched, yet wondering about her marriage. Women just like Dorothea had not entered into his traditions.
"It was right of you to tell me. I thank you for telling me the truth."
"I wish you to understand that I shall not say anything to enlighten Mr. Casaubon himself. I think it desirable for him to know nothing more than that he must not overwork himself and must observe certain rules. Anxiety of any kind would be precisely the most unfavourable condition for him."
End of Disc 9.